Welcome to the Bill Barnwell Show. I'm Bill Barnwell, and it's Monday, September 30th, 2019. We have two teams that are in flux in some strange way to talk about on today's show. We're going to get to the Browns, who had their best game of the year, I think, on Sunday, beating the Ravens later on in the show with Jake Trotter. But first, joining me to talk about the 3-1 Los Angeles Rams, who I think are in a really interesting spot right now in terms of they're exceeding expectations and simultaneously failing to live up to expectations, is the beat writer for us at ESPN who covers the Rams. It's Lindsay Theory. Lindsay, how are you?
Good. How are you today, Bill?
I'm good. And I wanted to bring you on. I talked to you sort of halfway between the Rams game yesterday and sort of in the second quarter, I think, because obviously they were in a very strange spot. They were down, I think, 21-0 to the Buccaneers. Mm-hmm. It was obviously a surprising game. It ended up becoming a very fun game to watch. It was crazy and back and forth, and the Bucs ended up winning 55-40. But I think we're in such an interesting spot with the Rams because the NFC is so wide open. There's no real dominant team right now. And so I guess where I want to start is with this. You know, if you told me before the year, or told a Rams fan before the year, they were going to start 3-1, I think you'd say, okay, well, that's not too bad. They have some tough games to start the year. If you had told them they were going to blow out the Saints and then lose to the Buccaneers at home, I think they would have been very confused by what would have happened over the first month of the year. So just to start, how do you think, based on what you're hearing from the fans who follow you, how do you think fans are feeling about this 3-1 start and about this Rams team right now?
Right now, I don't get the sense, at least on social media, which is not always the best gauge.
Sure.
But I don't get the sense that people are excited and happy with what they're seeing.
Mm-hmm.
The standard for the Rams is no longer just to win, but it's to win in exciting fashion.
Yep.
And that's what Sean McVay delivered the last two seasons. This offense looked like a well-oiled machine. It was exciting. It was Todd Gurley. It was Cooper Kupp, Robert Woods. And then you throw in Brandon Cooks on the deep balls, and everything just looked like it ran so well. And now this season, it's come to a screeching halt. They're not scoring touchdowns. There is no Todd Gurley, and Jared Goff does not look like a quarterback who just signed a $110 million guaranteed contract.
Yeah, I mean, it's weird because, you know, you look at the numbers. This team scored 33 points yesterday. Our offense scored 33 points, defense out of the pick six. Jared Goff threw for over 500 yards. They had two receivers over 120 yards. But absolutely, I mean, it does feel like, and I don't know if you agree with this, it seems like you do, the offense just feels disjointed maybe, or even if it is productive, it doesn't have that same sort of smoothness to it or that same sort of consistency when it comes to just blowing teams away drive after drive.
Yeah, I think that's a really fair way to put it. And it is misleading because you do look at the score from yesterday and you think, well, they are scoring. But it's now been through four first quarters that they haven't scored a touchdown. In two of their four games, they haven't scored a first half touchdown. But when you really, just the eyeball test, it doesn't pass. When you have watched Sean McVay's offense the last two seasons compared to what they do now, Jared Goff is throwing a step behind receivers on several plays. Now, don't get me wrong, he still has a few signature passes that, one to Robert Woods yesterday, another in the end zone to Gerald Everett, where you just say, wow, I mean, he's just really putting in a perfect spot where only his receiver can catch it. But again, there's just too many other throws where you're kind of shaking your head. And there's also been a few play designs from Sean McVay where he's clearly trying a few new things, which it's hard to fault him for that when you saw the results of the Super Bowl and clearly teams are catching on to his tricks. But a few new play designs that really have just been completely shut down. So it's this offense right now just doesn't look like they even know exactly who they want to be, where everything once started with Gurley in the run. Yesterday, Gurley only had, I think, five carries.
Yeah.
So it's really hard to determine. I mean, it almost looked like an air raid yesterday. I think Goff had 60 pass attempts, which is an absurd number for him.
Yeah, 68 pass attempts from Jared Goff, 70 dropbacks, which, I mean, just, you know, like to your point, it's like a college offense. And even given that the Rams are comfortable throwing the football a lot and were reasonably effective, if not necessarily dominant throwing the football yesterday, and given that they were playing a tough Bucs run defense, you can not, I wouldn't fault them a ton for throwing the ball more frequently than it might seem. But yeah, I mean, it just seems like this is an offense that is in transition. And I wonder, do you attribute some of this to Sean McVay's plan of having his starters, having his offense basically sit during the preseason, which has been the case for several years, it seems like?
Well, I think that given some of the changes that they're trying to implement, that seems to play some role in it. Now, it's maybe a little hard to tell just because they didn't play in the preseason last year and they went to a Super Bowl and they looked fantastic. So given the changes aren't wholesale changes, I mean, they're still mostly, there is some adjustment. They're mostly in 11 personnel. Mm-hmm. It's kind of hard to say why this season it's such a slow start when they didn't play in the preseason last year. It was a fast start. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they are working. Jared Goff is working behind a pretty new offensive line.
Yep.
The Rams lost Roger Saffold, the very, very sturdy left guard in free agency, and John Sullivan, who was breaking down physically, their old center. Mm-hmm. But mentally, he was so sharp, and every player on the offense always looked to him. And in news conferences weekly or talking at their lockers, they would always talk about what John brought to the field, mm-hmm. just as far as identifying what a defense was doing. And so now you replace those two players as two first-year offensive linemen, and I think this is kind of the result that this offensive line isn't as sturdy as it once was, which obviously affects Jared Goff. Mm-hmm. And also affects Todd Gurley in the run game.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. The offensive line was something I wanted to bring up because, you know, heading into the year, I brought up, you know, you thought about the guys you mentioned who are being replaced, where it's Joseph Noboom and Brian Allen now on the interior, and figured, okay, well, there'll be a drop-off there. It's, you know, the center's going to have to take more of the, you know, responsibilities for setting protections, or Jared Goff's going to take more of that role, and it's an inexperienced set of players versus John Sullivan. Roger Saffold's one of the best guards in football, and, you know, it might work out great if they happen to find a replacement, but you'd figure it was going to be a transition period. How are the tackles playing? You kind of figured that would be the strength of the offensive line with Andrew Whitworth, a Hall of Fame caliber player to me, and Rob Havenstein, two guys who are, you know, on expensive contracts. But through four games, they have five holding penalties. And last year, mm-hmm. they had three combined holding penalties over the entire season. So are they playing, or is it just sort of a random small sample? What's happening? Are the tackles playing at the same level they were a year ago?
I would definitely say that they are not, and that starts with Rob Havenstein. So he, between the false start penalties and the holding penalties, he's also been beat on several plays, which, you know, once in a while that is going to happen, sure. but it just seems to be happening at a higher rate, and he's gone against some good ends in Cam Jordan, yep. Myles Garrett,
sure.
but Rob has not played what he would probably say is to his standard. And then on the other side, Andrew Whitworth has been called for holding now. So those tackles, while we can't just harp on the interior of the line and the young guys, those tackles also haven't been playing to the standard in which they did the last couple of seasons. Now, we'll have open locker room today, and we'll probably stop and talk to those tackles and ask, is it because they're perhaps trying to make up for a weakness on the interior? Mm-hmm. Is it perhaps because they are just getting beat? Because it seems like there's more going on.
Yeah.
I'm concerned those two guys the last two seasons had no issue. And this season now it's becoming an issue.
Yeah, and it seems like maybe the, you know, the stuff you mentioned about trying new concepts on offense sort of gets them out of their comfort zone. I think, you know, this was an offense that for so long was able to just run outside zone, run play action off outside zone. Mm-hmm. Their movement was so consistent. They had a level of continuity with one another where they only really changed one offensive lineman between 2017 and 2018. So line had sort of coalesced. Everyone knew like what everyone else was going to do from play to play. And it seems like that's not necessarily the case right now. And you mentioned that how it would impact Todd Gurley. And of course, Todd Gurley is being impacted in another way. And I guess it depends on whether you're paying attention to what's actually happening on the field or you're listening to the Rams. The Rams have denied that there is a load management situation with Todd Gurley. It seems like in reality, though, that's not actually the case. Is that fair to say?
I think it's fair to say. I kind of waited a little bit, wanted to, obviously Sean McVay said it's not a load management situation, but you watch the first game, you watch the second game. Now we have four samples. And while his snap count was actually up this last week, that does skew it a little bit. They weren't given the ball in the running game. But at least through the first 3 weeks, his snap count was down 15% from what it was a season ago. And there's clearly been an obvious effort to have this offense not run through Todd Gurley. And that's, I think, where all the, this whole thing trips up, is because Todd Gurley, he was the NFL's offensive player of the year two seasons ago. He's an all-pro running back. When Sean McVay came to Los Angeles, everything went around Todd Gurley. And Sean has said multiple times throughout the offseason, through all this knee stuff, that Todd remained the focal point of the offense. Mm-hmm. And anybody who's watched this team for the last 4 weeks would have to agree. I don't know how they couldn't, that Todd Gurley is not the focal point of this offense. And therefore, that puts way more pressure on Jared Goff. And right now, Goff's not really been able to consistently handle that.
All right, Lindsay, well, let's talk more about this Rams offense and their struggles in a moment. But first, guys, hiring can be a slow process. And Cafe Altura's COO, Dylan Meskowitz, needed to hire a director of coffee for his organic coffee company. But you might expect, given that it's a very niche title, he was having trouble finding qualified applicants. Well, I think you guys know what he did. He switched to ZipRecruiter, because ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. And ZipRecruiter's technology identifies people with the right experience and invites them to apply to your job, so you get qualified candidates fast. Dylan posted his job on ZipRecruiter and said he was impressed by how quickly he had great candidates apply. He also used ZipRecruiter's candidate rating feature to filter his applicants, so he could focus on the most relevant ones. And that's how Dylan found his new director of coffee in just a few days. With results like that, it's no wonder 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. And you can see why ZipRecruiter is effective for businesses of all sizes by trying ZipRecruiter for free at our exclusive web address, which is ZipRecruiter.com/Barnwell, my last name, ZipRecruiter.com/Barnwell, B-A-R-N-W-E-L-L, ZipRecruiter.com/Barnwell. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Now back to the show. In terms of what's happening with Todd Gurley, in terms of what the Rams are saying versus what they're doing, which has been there's been a gap there going back to, you know, last December and last January. I mean, do you think the Rams are in denial about Todd Gurley? Are they just trying to put on a brave face and just saying things that they know necessarily aren't accurate to the media and to the public? Or do you think they just think that, or do you think they really believe what they're saying, I guess? I mean, it just seems like it's at odds with what's actually happening.
Well, I can't imagine that they actually believe what they're saying when they say it's not load management, because Todd did not participate in team drills through the off-season program. They called it a carefully monitored workload, a scheduled workload through training camp, when Todd practiced every other day through training camp. And then Sean McVay said that would carry through the regular season during the work week. He'd practice every other day. Now, that hasn't actually been every other day. He's practiced Wednesdays, Thursdays, and he takes off on Fridays. Mm-hmm. He doesn't participate in practice on Fridays as they prepare for Sunday games. So that's been really interesting. And in fact, Gurley was asked about that. He was asked, you know, are you going to be on this every other day practice schedule, and why is that? And he told reporters, you know, I don't know if you've been paying attention from last season, but nothing's changed. And well, that's just not the case, because Todd Gurley practiced every day in past seasons. He didn't take off Fridays. And yeah, the weird thing about this is there'd probably be no shame in the Rams just saying that they need to do a better job at making sure their workhorse can last through 16 games,
right,
plus the playoff. There's no shame in that. So it seems like they've taken such an odd route to otherwise make sure that Gurley's not, you know, carrying the ball for 1,100, 1,200 yards, plus adding another 500 receiving yards. They've taken a very roundabout way, and it's making them look not great, seeing as we all see every Sunday how he's being used, and it's clearly very different.
Yeah, it just doesn't add up to me. You know, I try to be honest at all times. You know, I think everyone tells a lie here and there, and everyone maybe lies to themselves here and there, but it does seem like it just doesn't add up. And, like, I don't know if they're paying attention to it or just don't care. But the other thing that seems interesting to me about the running game is that, you know, the hot sort of name heading into the season in the backfield was Daryl Henderson. You know, obviously a guy who was going super high in fantasy drafts relative to being a mid-round pick behind a, you know, a possible star back. I think people expected him to be a big part of this offense, at least for, you know, a couple series per game. And he's basically been on the bench for the entirety of the first month of the season. Are you surprised by that? And do you think it's going to change as the season goes on?
You know, I'm not too surprised about it. And I think, like everybody else, when they picked Daryl Henderson in the third round, my eyebrows raised, and I was like, whoa, what are they doing here? Mm-hmm. But Sean McVay, while he's always quite positive about all of his players and sees everything on the bright side and glass half full, there was a comment he made back in the preseason. I believe it was after they played in Hawaii. It might have actually even been week one, mm-hmm. where he just kind of talked about how Henderson definitely had some things he needed to pick up. I mean, this is like pass protection and different nuances of the offense that he really needed to see Henderson get involved with. So I am not shocked to see that as a rookie, Daryl Henderson is not getting the run that many people thought perhaps he would. Mm-hmm. Just because when McVay kind of delves into the details of the game like that, which happens quite rarely, it's a little bit of a red flag that pops up and you start to realize, okay, this guy's definitely got some issues and, mm-hmm. and things he has to learn before McVay feels comfortable inserting him. And I think that's what we're seeing, which again might be overanalyzation on my part, going back to one comment after one preseason game. But when you kind of look at what's happened in the past with a few players right. on offense, especially, that's been the case and that's been the trend for McVay. And especially in 11 personnel and as he's kind of resorted to in the past, he's got his 11 guys. And this year, you know, maybe go 12 with 13 even, go 12 with Malcolm Brown, 13 with mm-hmm. Gerald Everett. But beyond that, if you don't really work into his plan early in the season, you just don't really ever make the Sean McVay plan. And I think that's maybe what we're seeing right now with Daryl Henderson.
Yeah, I mean, a full 95% of Los Angeles offensive snaps through 2 weeks, has been with either three or four wide receivers on the field. So, I mean, mm-hmm. obviously getting Everett back is going to, you know, they might go with it more frequently, but absolutely it's been, you know, a lot of three and four wide sets and, you know, a lot of the sort of pass heavy sets that we've come to know from Sean McVay at this point. And I feel like, you know, we talked a little bit about this during the Super Bowl week, that they might try and go with more 12 personnel in the Super Bowl, which I don't think they really did that much. But one of the reasons it made sense to do that was because the Rams at that point didn't have Cooper Kupp, who was out for the year with a torn ACL. And mm-hmm. at least right now, when I watch this offense, it really feels like from week to week, Cooper Kupp is the guy who's keeping this offense afloat. Is that fair to say?
Yeah. Well, yesterday it was interesting because Cooper, through the first half, had don't remember the exact numbers, but it's like mm-hmm. he was kind of non-existent in the game. And it was Robert Woods, who's been, you know, quote unquote, Mr. Dependable, Mr. Consistency the last couple of seasons, who really had come through. But by the end of the game, you know, Cooper Kupp in the second half really kind of came on. But week in and week out now, it's the guy coming off an ACL injury who's looked the sharpest, who's been able to have significant bursts down the field, breaking mm-hmm. tackles, yards after catch. I mean, the guy's phenomenal at it. But it really seems like this is a Jared Goff, Cooper Kupp-driven offense right now. And if those two aren't in sync, which I don't think they were necessarily through the first half yesterday, mm-hmm. then everything else kind of falls apart, which is, it's really interesting to think that it's Jared and the slot receiver who are kind of relied on to get things done right now.
What I find so interesting about that is, well, Cooper Kupp is one of the few players in this offense who isn't on a long-term deal for significant money. I mean,
Making no money, Bill.
He's making no poor guy.
I wrote about this 2 weeks ago, maybe, and I was looking up Cooper Kupp's salary, and I was like, that poor guy is just making nothing when he looks either side of him in the locker room, and you got Brandon Cooks on a five-year or something, $81 million deal. Robert mm-hmm. Woods is on a $34 million deal. Looking it up, Cooper Kupp this season making $811,000.
Right. I'm like, you know, sure, good money. I mean, obviously, $800,000
is nice. Oh, yeah.
But
I think I'd be happy with that. But.
Sure. But relative to the other guys in this offense where you have not just Brandon Cooks, not just Robert Woods, but also Todd Gurley, Jared Goff now, Whitworth, Havenstein, you have so many guys who are making significant money that it's just fascinating that the Rams are being bailed out in some cases by a slot receiver making $800,000. And of course, you would figure after this year, given the Rams' history, they're going to pay Cooper Kupp. He's going to be a very valuable player for them to keep. But as Jared Goff's cap hit, at least right now, before any restructures, is set to rise from $10.7 million to, I believe, $36 million next year.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it just sort of reinforces that, at least maybe not reinforces, but I wonder if they're going to have to make a cutback elsewhere to accommodate handing Cooper Kupp a big new contract.
Yeah, well, they're definitely going to have to take a look. There's a couple guys on expiring deals. I mean, Aqib Talib, Marcus Peters, Dante Fowler. So when you look at the defense, that's really where they're probably going to take a hit. Andrew Whitworth, the left tackle, this is the last year of his contract this year. So there's several guys out there where they're going to have to make some decisions. You know, who gets the franchise tag? Who are they going to have to let go because they simply aren't going to have the money to pay him? Because Cooper Kupp is not – I can't imagine there'd be any way – they would want Cooper Kupp to leave Los Angeles. Right. They love everything that he brings to the table. And has obviously his work ethic, his production, but also he's a guy who's in quarterback meetings. I mean, he's like a coach on the field. Mm-hmm. He knows the nuances of this offense, and he's like he's in lockstep with Jared Goff most of the time and with Sean McVay. So he is a very, very valuable piece to them.
Yeah, absolutely. So now a short week coming up for the Rams after the first loss of the season. They travel to Seattle to play the Seahawks, obviously a very tough place to play on a short week. Is this game more important, you think, to the Rams now than you would have expected heading into the season?
Yeah, I absolutely would think it is. I think that we all predicted the NFC West would be improved, especially given the San Francisco 49ers and getting Jimmy Garoppolo back.
Sure.
But I think that this is going to be a real dogfight in the NFC West. I mean, the Seahawks and the Rams right now, both 3-1. The 49ers undefeated coming off their bye week. So I think that this game in Seattle, I don't want to say it's a must win because there's still plenty of football to be played, but this is going to be no cakewalk in the NFC West like it was for them last year when they swept the division. So I think for them to avoid losing back-to-back games and to just get a little bit of confidence back, because I know through three wins, the narrative and the story in that media room every day is that the offense just doesn't look right. And Sean McVay has admitted it, and so has Jared Goff. And now they have a loss, not only because of the offense, obviously the defense got off to a pretty horrendous start on Sunday, but really it's the offense that has not been able to provide any juice. So it's not a must win, but it definitely would help their long-term cause.
Yeah, I mean, as I finish up here, I guess we haven't talked about the defense very much. It did give up 48 points yesterday, ignoring the Ndamukong Suh touchdown that finished the game. But a defense that was, you know, facing a Buccaneers team that I think we don't really take seriously, and perhaps unfairly to Buccaneers fans, but a team that you kind of expected, okay, well, Jameis Winston's going to have a bad game because he's, you know, on the road facing a tough Rams defense, but 28 of 41 for 385, four touchdowns, the really one ugly pick six. But an offense that moved the ball and picked up first downs when they needed to time after time against the Rams defense. So is there one thing that concerns you about this Rams defense that they have to fix in the weeks to come as they play Seattle and San Francisco?
You know, I'm trying to, as I kind of delve back into what happened yesterday, I'm trying to figure out if this is like kind of a one-off anomaly for them where everyone just came out and had a poor game. I was talking to a couple of players afterward, and they said they didn't have any energy across the board, no energy. So I know going into the game, they were asked, is this a trap game? And is this something where we can get caught coming off the Browns win and looking ahead to the Seahawks on a short week? And they were all, no, no, no. But I think that maybe like the rest of us, they came in and said, well, it's the Bucs. We'll just go out there and run through the motions. And that's exactly what it looked like through the first quarter. They ran through the motions and then realized, oh, my gosh, we're down 21-0 as they got through the first half. So I'm not too concerned about the defense. Now, obviously, if they go out and lay another egg this week, that's obviously reason for concern. But because of how well they played and how dominant they played, keeping their offense in it the last 3 weeks, I'm going to kind of chalk this one up as to anomaly. I mean, they hadn't allowed, going into yesterday, a passing play of more than 30 yards, and then Jameis Winston just made them look silly.
Yeah.
So I'm going to chalk that one up to they didn't show up, and they realized that they can no longer just go through the motions that they want to win week in and week out.
Yeah, I mean, to that point, biggest play of the game for the Bucs was the 67-yard Mike Evans touchdown on a play where they were in, you know, had no safety help, cover zero, man coverage across the field, and Marcus Peters thinks they're in zone and lets Mike Evans run by him. It's a mental mistake, and obviously the talent's there, so, you know, I think you bet on the talent, but, I mean, obviously this is a Rams team that it's weird, you know, like they're 3-1, they're in great shape, they're going to make the playoffs, you would figure, they're, you know, in a tougher division than I think people expected, but still a good football team by all, you know, estimations, a relatively healthy football team as well. And it still feels like there's so much doubt about what this Rams team is going to do. Maybe it just raised expectations, but a really fascinating situation happening in Los Angeles.
No doubt. And it's going to be, I think, fascinating going forward because the Rams are now kind of the hunted, as they say, coming off that Super Bowl. And with all these coaches and all these teams hearing nothing but how great and how much of a masterful offensive mind Sean McVay was, that it puts a target on your back. So you better believe teams spent the entire offseason trying to figure out how to stop this offense. And it looks like they've effectively done so through 4 weeks. So it'll be really interesting to see what kind of adjustments the Rams can come up with going forward.
All right. Well, Lindsay, if people want to check out your Rams coverage, where can they do that?
ESPN.com, hit the Rams page, and then you can follow me also on Twitter at Lindsay Theory.
Lindsay, thank you so much. We're going to come back after the break, talk about the Browns with Jake Trotter here on the Bill Barnwell Show. Back here on the Bill Barnwell Show, I'm Bill Barnwell of ESPN. We spent the first half of the show talking about a team that had looked impressive, maybe took a step backwards last week in the 3-1 Rams. We're going to go in the other direction, talk about a team that was disappointing, perhaps, to some people through 3 weeks of the season. And then I think, and I want to know what you think as well, I guess, but a team that delivered their best performance on Sunday in a comprehensive victory over the Ravens. We're going to talk about the Cleveland Browns. And joining me to do that is ESPN's Jake Trotter. Jake, how are you?
What's going on, Bill? Good to be on with you again.
Happy to have you on again. Last time you had just started with the Cleveland Browns beat. You were just moving. You've obviously seen this team play for 4 weeks now. I mean, do you think what we saw from them on Sunday was sort of the sort of performance Browns fans and Browns players and Browns coaches were expecting heading into the season?
Yeah, undoubtedly their best performance of the year. And I think the offense we've been waiting to see since they traded for Odell Beckham. Like, the first three games, you'd see flashes of it, but from first to fourth quarter, it was too inconsistent. And in this game, we finally saw what they were capable of. And the ironic part is Odell Beckham only had two catches. He didn't have any until the fourth quarter. So it just kind of underscored the depth of firepower that they have and the different ways that they can beat you.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. It seemed like it was a performance that was really complete. You know, it wasn't just, hey, we hit one big play, or hey, we, you know, had Odell Beckham make, one of the greatest catches of his career, or we just took advantage of a Jets team that was down to their third string, their third string quarterback, or we came up with a couple of interceptions and comes to some short fields that way. It felt like start to finish, they were a better team than what looks to be the best team in the AFC North. And I think that has to be really promising. You know, it really felt like, you know, for the first week, this is a not just a team with a few great players, but a great team top to bottom.
Yeah, and for all the consternation, Baker Mayfield overrated as hell. You know, Freddie Kitchens doesn't know what he's doing as first-time head coach. I mean, you know, the Browns have taken some hits publicly, and yet here they are atop the AFC North for the first time in 5 years. Really with the inside track in the division because they have the road win at Baltimore. And after they get to these next three games, the schedule opens up with them. Yeah. I mean, I haven't looked at it, Bill, but they've got to have one of the easiest schedules in the NFL after they go to New England. They have 7 games, not counting the Monday night game tonight because somebody's got to win between Cincinnati and Pittsburgh. But they have 7 games after New England against teams that have yet to win a game. So they have a real opportunity to surge here. And if they continue to show what they did Sunday offensively, I think that they have a chance to still be a 10-win type team, you know, despite the lackluster start.
Yeah, absolutely. I think only the Jets, just based on just looking, you know, not actually running the numbers, but just on, you know, eyeing the schedule, have an easier schedule over the final, you know, 9 games or 8 games of the year, second half of the season than the Browns do. A bunch of home games, still have a home game against the Dolphins, which is about as guaranteed of a victory as there is in football right now. And a team that I think, based on what we saw on Sunday, is kind of coalescing. We saw an offensive line that has really struggled for stretches of the season, only allow 1 sack yesterday against the Ravens defense, which we all expect to be pretty good. Might not be the case. I know they have a lot of changes. They seem to have some dissension on that side of the ball. But I think Ravens defense that we expect to be pretty good because they're the Ravens. And what I found interesting was that you look at the numbers for Baker Mayfield. Before week 4, he had taken 3.03 seconds for his typical pass. That was the third highest figure in the NFL. Yesterday, the second quickest release in the NFL, 2.44 seconds. And his numbers drastically improved over the course of his career. when he's getting the ball out quickly versus holding on to it to try and make plays. Do you think there was a significant change in how the Browns operated their offense on Sunday, or was it more just that they got better results from the things they did, even if it wasn't that much different from what they were doing over the first 3 weeks of the year?
No, I think there was some dramatic adjustments. And I think they kind of started that against the Rams. You saw a lot more RPO, trying to get the ball out of Baker's hands quicker than the first 2 weeks of the season. The other adjustment they made yesterday is they were under center a lot more. Against the Rams, they were shotgun, I believe, 76% of the time. Against Baltimore, it was just 52% of the time. That's a season low for them. And I think that allowed them to get Nick Chubb more involved, set up play action, take some pressure off Baker. So I just think that adjustment alone, getting under center and showing more of a threat to run the ball, keeping their offense balanced, made a huge difference. And, you looked at the numbers, and this is why I was never overly concerned about the way Baker was playing, mm-hmm. was you just hit it on the head. When he was getting rid of the ball, he was fine. Like, he was accurate. He was making plays. It was when he was holding on to the ball, and I think they were trying to unlock some things downfield with Odell that weren't really there, or Baker was trying to force things to Odell that weren't really there. He had over the first three games, the highest rate of throwing a pass into double coverage of any quarterback in the NFL over a three-game
wow.
stretch. Guess who was getting all those targets?
Right.
It was Odell Beckham. And so I think that let's take what the defense gives us. They're going to take Odell out of the game, fine. We're going to find Jarvis Landry. We're going to hit our tight ends. We're going to get the ball to Nick Chubb. And you saw what the offense can do when they don't try to force the ball to Odell. So I think getting under center, getting the ball out of Baker's hands, mm-hmm. not forcing the ball to Odell, running the ball, those were a lot of the adjustments they made, and it really paid off in the result that you saw.
Yeah, you tweeted about this. They were in shotgun way less frequently in week four than they had been over the prior 3 weeks of the season.
Right, and I think that Nick Chubb running for 165 yards was not an accident. I think that they came into that game, okay, let's run the ball more than let's be physical in the running game, because Nick Chubb is the most underrated part of this offense. He's a terrific running back, underrated breakaway speed, but can be physical between the tackles. And, they had run the ball well at times with him this season, but it just kind of felt like they would get away from it and get back to empty shotgun or exclusively, RPO with Nick Chubb and nothing else. And they were a lot more versatile with their running game, showed a lot more with Chubb, and they never got away from it either. They stuck with it. And that's when you saw that 88-yard touchdown run that was the backbreaker. It's because they never abandoned the running game like they had at times through the first 3 weeks. And, when you can run the ball like that and you've got Odell Beckham and Jarvis Landry too, you can be pretty devastating offensively.
Yeah, Jarvis Landry also had a big game, 8 catches, 167 yards. And, some of that was just, there was a poor tackling attempt on his long, I believe it was 60-yard catch, 65-yard catch and run. But was there something different, you think, to get Jarvis Landry more involved with the offense this week? Or was it just simply, we're going to throw to the open guy, and Jarvis Landry happened to be the open guy more often than Odell Beckham this week?
Yeah, I think it was the latter. Jarvis coming into the weekend ranked 147 in receptions per target, which is way below what, his career averages have been. He's been an excellent possession receiver, and I don't know exactly why it was so low. I think it was this game is a little bit, progression to the mean. I think that the Ravens were going to take Odell Beckham out of the game, and so Cleveland countered with, okay, how can we get Jarvis Landry involved? They did a lot of creative stuff with him. At one point, they ran like a triple option play where Baker flipped it forward, and then Jarvis had the option to pitch to Odell or keep it himself. I think Jarvis, he broke some tackles too.
Yeah.
He had more yards after the catch on that one run you were referencing than he had the first three games combined. So, at the end of the day, sometimes it's just guys playing better. But I think that they did a much better job of allocating the ball to where it needed to go instead of trying to force it to a certain area that wasn't there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. That's how the best offenses in the league work. And it seems like as good as the Browns' weapon are, as good as it is to throw the ball to Odell Beckham, obviously it was more effective just throwing to the open receiver yesterday You covered Baker for a long time. And so I think I want your opinion on this because obviously it's sort of a conflict for us in some ways. Our colleague is Rex Ryan, who works on Sunday night on the Sunday morning show for us at ESPN. There's been some back and forth there. Baker has said repeatedly, you know, if you're not in this locker room, if you don't wear brown and orange, you don't matter. But at the same time, Baker is responding to comments publicly. So, I mean, from your perspective, how much of what makes Baker Mayfield tick, how much of what makes him going is sort of feeding off that criticism? Does it really not matter that much in the long run, or is it really, you know, does he need that to kind of thrive and play his best football?
He needs it. Yeah, you know, he wasn't going to give Rex Ryan any credit for the win. You know, he explicitly stated that afterward. But Baker is uniquely better when he is in the fray. When he is going back and forth, I mean, there's like a million examples of this now throughout his career. I mean, there were two this week alone, whether it was Rex Ryan or Antonio Brown, but he is better when he is in the fray, and I think he gets a lot of his edge from that. You know, he used to keep like we always say, you know, you're in my book for that. He actually had like a list. You're on the list. He actually kept a real list of people that he felt like had slighted him.
That's incredible.
And he doesn't have it anymore. But at one point he did, because he would use that to get that edge, you know, he needed to play with. You know, Baker was never, you know, the prototypical quarterback. You know, he had to win a different kind of way. You know, part of what makes him, you know, a special player is, you know, the edge that he brings to the field that's maybe different than other quarterbacks. I mean, there's one, if you watch that, Nick, go back and watch that Nick Chubb touchdown run, the 88 yarder. Yep. Like, look in the background and look who is running down the field like a madman in the replay. It's Baker Mayfield. And I just think that he, for whatever reason, makes him tick. He is better when he is in the middle of all this stuff. And he's better when he's talking trash on the field. You know, he is better when he is in the fray. And I think that bared out this week, because it was by far the best game he has played this season.
Yeah, Baker Mayfield on that play, his max speed topped out at 18.8 miles per hour. To put that in context, that was faster than 9 of the 11 Ravens players who were theoretically chasing after Nick Chubb on the 88-yard touchdown run. That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, I think it was his fastest clock time of the year on that sprint to the end zone.
Yeah, I mean, it was, you know, I'm sure it was thrilling for everyone. It was kind of like having to deal with, you know, all this hype and all this frustration and all the back and forth struggles. I mean, all the sort of, you know, criticism to have that moment of, okay, we're probably going to win this game. Here's a huge moment for one of our best players. Like, it must have been very cathartic, even for week 4 of the season.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, one thing too, Odell deserves a lot of credit because, you know, I don't, his reputation is what it is for whatever reason, but like, at not one moment, you know, during the struggle that they had to start this season, did he ever show up Freddie or Baker, even in the slightest way, whether it was some body language movement. And, you know, he never got frustrated, despite the fact he wasn't getting any touches on Sunday. And, you know, there was one sequence that I thought was really revealing. I think Odell ran a little bit of a curl pattern. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the entire secondary got sucked up into it. And that allowed Ricky Seals-Jones to get wide open. I think it was 8.8 yards of separation, the longest of any completion that Baker's had in his entire career. And you just look back at Odell, and he was pumping his fist. And I think if he can continue to play football that way, it's going to make a huge difference for Baker, where Baker doesn't feel like he has to force the ball to Odell. And then just on the field, it's just going to open up so much for the rest of the team. So, I mean, I think even though Odell, you know, it's not, if you're a fantasy football owner of Odell, like myself, it's not a great day for him.
Sure.
But for the Browns, I think it was a low-key great day because it really showed how he can impact the game without even touching the ball.
Yeah, absolutely. On the flip side of the ball, talk a little bit briefly about the defense. Are you surprised that the secondary has been able to sort of keep its head above water for the last 2 weeks, given that it's been, you know, mostly backups in at cornerback and safety?
I have been surprised, although I think that if they were going to have an injury somewhere, corner is the one spot they felt like they could overcome, because they've got a couple of pros invest in T.J. Carey and Terrence Mitchell, guys that have started before, you know, guys that are reliable, and they have really answered the bell. Because you go against the Rams and that receiving core, and then the speed that Baltimore has, and they have held up really well both times. So I think it's been really impressive and an underrated part of why they're 2-2, because Hollywood Brown and Mark Andrews and those guys have been difficult to deal with this year. And I actually kind of thought the speed was going to be a problem for Cleveland, and it really wasn't, because those guys played so well. And at some point they're going to get Denzel Ward and Greedy Williams back, and you feel really good about a cornerback foursome of those two guys along with Mitchell and Carey, the way that they played.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they're clearly playing at a level higher than you would have expected, even given that the Browns do have a good pass rush. But I think they've sort of held their own in a way that has to be promising, has to make you feel better about your secondary going forward, even if you lose Denzel Ward for a couple weeks down the line during the second half of the season.
The defense has been really good this year. I mean, you take out the Tennessee game, which was such a weird game because of the 18 penalties. I mean, you almost have to throw it out, because when you're just giving the team first downs or you're constantly in first and 25, it's really hard to get a good read of what kind of team you have. But since then, they have been really good. I mean, they gave the offense really struggled in that Rams game. They gave the Browns still a chance to win, and they were great against Baltimore as well. So, I felt like they had a chance to have a top 10 defense, at least according to, FPI. And they have kind of been right there, and they've done it with some injuries that you mentioned as well.
Yeah, and I mean, that's absolutely surprising. Not the fact that the defense would have a top 10 ceiling is not high, not surprising to me, but do it without Denzel Ward, do it without Greedy Williams for 2 weeks. And like you said, really, it's just the one Tennessee game where, the second half kind of got away from them, especially, there was Baker Mayfield turning the ball over, putting them in bad situations, some defensive scores, short fields. That obviously contributed to it as well. But, yeah, I mean, I think a team that we saw their ceiling on Sunday. We saw they can be a dominant team on both sides of the football. And so as we sort of think about the Browns going forward, given what you've seen from them from 4 weeks, have your expectations for their season changed after 4 weeks versus what you were expecting heading into the year?
I picked them to go 10-6 and win the AFC North, and I think that's what I would pick them to do if I had to repick it today. I haven't gone back through the schedule to pick wins and losses, but it just kind of felt like to me, if they could get to, say, 3-4, which I don't think is too difficult for them now. They just have to win one game after New England. With the way the schedule sets up for them, I mean, there's just a lot of wins there for them. And then you watch them and the way that they've sort of figured out some things offensively, you would think, going forward, and then defensively as well as they've played. I don't think they're in the tier with Kansas City or New England as a, bona fide Super Bowl contender, but I think they're in that next tier of teams that could win a playoff game, that could certainly get to the playoffs. And you look at where Cleveland's been in football purgatory for the last three decades.
Right.
I think they have a terrific chance to break the NFL's longest divisional drought, which goes back to 1989. And I think they have a really good chance to break the NFL's longest playoff drought, which goes back to 2002. So when you put it in that context, I think that they are in really good shape right now.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think, it looked pretty ugly after the first week of the year. It looked like it was going to be a problem after the Ravens started 2-0, but Ravens lose 2 straight, lose to the Browns on the road. The Steelers look like a mess right now. The Bengals have just been destroyed by injuries. Obviously, like you said, one of those teams has to win tonight, but you would figure they're prohibitive favorites now. They're in great shape, and absolutely, as the schedule sort of weakens during the second half, this could be a team where you do run off a 6-2 or 7-1 second half and then head into the postseason, with 10 wins and look like one of the more devastating teams in the league. So, yeah, I think the Browns are well positioned to kind of be the team we expected it and sort of be the favorites to win the AFC North. But we're going to keep monitoring it. And Jake, of course, you're going to keep covering it for us at ESPN. But if people want to check out more of what you do, where can they do that?
They can find me on ESPN.com along with you, Bill, particularly on the NFL page, and then I'm all over Twitter.
Always a pleasure. Right. I'll be back on later on in the year, but thanks so much for hopping on the show today.
Thanks. Anytime, Bill. Take care.
All right. Thanks so much to my guest today from ESPN, Lindsay Theory, who covers the Rams, Jake Trotter, who covers the Browns. We have more audio coming later on this week. We're going to do another podcast previewing the action for week 5. Already 4 full weeks into the season after Monday night tonight. It's already a quarter of the way into the year for most of the NFL's teams. Very, very strange start to the year, but hope you're enjoying the stuff we're doing here on ESPN, and more on the way.